This is Matt Freitas, and you're listening to the Late Night History Podcast. Tonight's guest is Andrew Sully Sullivan, a native of Worcester, Mass., who went on to serve a career in the SEAL teams, including a stint at SEAL Team 2 and 11 years at the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, otherwise known as SEAL Team 6. Some history highlights from the episode include SEAL training, humanity in war, the comedies that provided hilarious one-liners that became part of the SEAL's vocabulary in the GWAD, pre-mission rituals, video games, and so much more. After medically retiring from the Navy, Sully found his new mission, to protect American communities. He founded the Community First Project, a nonprofit that provides law enforcement officers, specifically patrol officers, or school resource officers, the fundamentals of a tactical response to an active shooter or critical incident like an act of terror. As Sully puts it, you're asking officers to respond to a Tier 1 Navy SEAL level operation with little to no training and expecting a SEAL team outcome. That's just not reality. Fortunately, the Community First Project is filling this void with a plan to positively impact change through police reform. So, here is episode 37. I'm sitting here with Andrew Sully Sullivan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Matt. Appreciate you getting me here.
So, as we do, can you start by telling us a little bit about your childhood, like the hometown where you grew up?
Of course. Yeah, you know, we're both Massachusetts guys, right? So, yeah, I grew up in Worcester. You know, generationally, you know, go back to my great-great-grandparents. I grew up in the same house that my mother grew up in, that my grandfather helped to build. You know, one of those neighborhoods that was, all the neighbors lived there for their entire lives. So all the older folks in the neighborhoods were always Nani and Poppy, or you know, it was like family, even though we weren't related. Just, you know, they raised my mom, and then my brother and I came in and they raised us. Yes. Couldn't get away with anything, but you know, it was fun to try, right?
Cool. And do you have any family lineage as far as cops or military?
Yeah, I think great grandfather was a cop in Worcester. My grandfather was a Marine, and my father was in the National Guard. And I'm sure if I dug into my extended family, we could probably find some people that were in the law enforcement profession or in the military. But as far as is my immediate family, that's it.
Awesome. And as I do with the show, I like to ask like food centric questions, just because, you know, it's what we do here. And do you have any like mom and pop shop restaurants in Worcester, or like bar pizza places?
Oh God, there's so many of them. It was really cool. There's a lot of mom and pop family owned restaurants. And I'll caveat that with, it's been a while since I've been back to Worcester. More or less, I think my grandfather passed was probably about the last time I was out that way. And that's been a minute. So, but yeah, just growing up, you know, I remember eating, you know, fried fish on Fridays. That was the thing. As an Irish Catholic kid growing up in Massachusetts, and there was a couple of different places that we would get fish from, mostly bars, right? I remember, I think it was Sunni's down, pretty sure that was the place. But yeah, we'd go in there and you get wrapped in paper, and it was all greasy, and it was so good. You know, hit Shrewsbury Street because you get your meatball grinders over there. Some of the best Italian food that I've had in my travels anyway. And certainly Papa Gino's was always a winner for me growing up. But the Boynton, as I got older, we would always hit the Boynton on North Works. Those were kind of my parents' go-to places. So they would always drag me and my brother there, and we would eat there as well. So there's definitely no shortage of good food. And it is one of the things that I missed most when I left Massachusetts, like just the basic stuff, like the sandwiches. You don't get grinders like that anywhere else in the country. And it's different.
Yeah. I love that. Papa Gino's, shout out to Papa Gino's, a classic New England.
Yeah. He can't have Big Boys, like Sunday breakfast going to Big Boys in Worcester. Oh, it was great. You know, remember they had a big statue up front holding the burger up. It was fantastic. It was probably terrible, and I just didn't know any better, but, you know, it was fantastic to me.
Yeah, like comfort food. So I love it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And how were you as did you play sports growing up? How were you in academics?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely played sports. That's kind of what my brother and I did. If we weren't in the house, we were outside playing wiffle ball or shooting baskets or, you know, doing something in the neighborhood with the kids, riding our bikes and building jumps. We were outdoors kids as much as we could be living in the city. And you know, eventually we get a little older and move to the suburbs, and same thing. We're just always outside trying to play football, baseball, basketball. It didn't matter. And we got old enough to play organized. We did. We you know, started with t-ball and then basketball, and even played soccer. It didn't matter. As long as I was doing something, I was playing, and I did that up to high school and into college.
Yeah, that pretty much mirrors me and my brother, except for I just did it up until high school. But like baseball, football, I played golf for a little bit, but I'm actually pretty bad at golf. But that's a whole thing.
You know, as am I. I've played golf my whole life, and I don't seem to get any better. It's one of those sports where the more you play, I feel like the worse you get. And it's finding the time is hard now, but it's a struggle and such a hard sport to get good at.
Yeah, it's definitely all about consistency, and you just got to have like a level head, 'cause like you can't let a bad shot go to you. Like go to your head, you know.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, I played baseball my whole life. So when I play golf, it's all right, I'm going to try and hit the ball as far as I possibly can. And then I do, but it's in the wrong direction. So usually I'm getting a new ball.
Yeah, same. So, like, as a student wise, like, did you like school? What was your favorite, subject? Did you have plans to go to like college after or?
I liked being able to play sports. So I think I dealt with school because it allowed me to do that. You know, as a kid with ADD and not really knowing it at the time until I was an adult, but I had zero interest in sitting down and sitting still and studying and doing homework and any of that stuff. And I was good enough to get A's and B's and C's. You know, occasionally I get a bad grade in the subject that I could care less about or wasn't very good at, but for the most part, I always passed. But I also didn't put a ton of effort in the way I probably should have. And I liked the social aspect of school. I like being there and seeing my friends and hanging out and playing sports, but I didn't like the studying part of it, let's say. Not until I was an adult. You know, when I got back into school as an adult and getting my master's and my college degree, it was a different story. You know, I found something I was passionate about and enjoyed, and it was a lot easier to put the effort into it and dedicate myself to getting through it. Yeah, when I did finish high school, I went to college for a couple of years, went to East Carolina University in North Carolina, which I think I was 17 when I graduated. So my topic or my major area of study was beer and liquor and women, and that was about it. So I didn't apply or do well in school when it was, you know, I didn't have a parent looking over my shoulder telling me, "Hey, sit your ass down and do this." So that didn't go well. I was there a year and a half. Then I went to Worcester State for a little while, did a little better. Went to the football team there. That you know, it didn't last. I was ineligible, and yeah, kind of at that point, I'm like, you know what, this isn't for me. And I left school, and I ended up moving down to the DC area, and that's where I joined the military.
What time frame was like college and then that like right around the military?
You're asking me to date myself, Matt. Come on, man. Okay, I graduated high school in '94. I went to St. Peter Marion, yeah, right in Worcester. So I kind of bounced around a little bit with the family. I went to high school in Maryland as well for a couple of years, and then I finished up my senior year in '94 at St. Peter Marion, East Carolina. Came back to Massachusetts, and I ended up in Maryland, D.C. area around '99, I think '99, 2000, and then I spent 2 years or so working for Enterprise Rent-A-Car, which is crazy. I ended up bumping into a friend of mine I knew from high school that I still know to this day. And he had just started working there and got me an interview, and yeah, did that for a few years. And you know, I learned a lot about running a business, that's for sure. But it wasn't a very exciting job either. But yeah, 9/11 happened, and the next day I was looking for a recruiter to like get me out of here.
Do you remember where you were on 9/11?
I do. I was in a BMW dealership renting cars, and I remember thinking, And I don't mean this as an insult to BMW drivers by any means, but I'm there working and watching it happen on TV. I think the first plane had hit the tower. The second plane had not hit the tower. They started talking about the Pentagon, and my dad worked in DC at the time. And I didn't want to work. I wanted to watch TV. And all these people, you know, dropping off their BMWs for service and wanting to rent cars could care less what was going on TV. And of course, they didn't know what was going on. We didn't know it was an act of terror. We just knew a plane hit the building at that point. And I just remember being so miffed that these motherfuckers didn't want to stop and see this life-changing event as it was happening. They couldn't be bothered. And I was already thinking, man, you know, I had in my head, if this is an attack, I got to do something. I got to do something. And, you know, I'd wanted to join the teams for a long time. And I think that it was that event and me being where I was at in life with really nothing against Enterprise, but it wasn't a road to a happy life for me, you know, moving up within the ranks of Enterprise Rent-A-Car. And I knew I needed more and I needed to do something to give back and protect my family. And standing there in that BMW dealership, and especially after it, you know, second plane hit the Pentagon, the Pennsylvania, I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is a sign to me that I have to do something. And that's kind of what led me to joining.
And was there did you know like a team guy, or did you read any books, or how did you learn about like the SEAL teams?
Yeah, I don't know how I knew about the SEAL teams. You know, I remember even growing up in Massachusetts in Worcester in the city, you know, we would go play, we called it Vietnam. You know, we'd go find some woods and we'd all get guns and we'd team up. And it was kind of like laser tag before we had laser tag, where you'd go out and hunt each other down. And I was always fascinated by the military, and especially growing up in Massachusetts. And I know it's a very liberal state, but it's also super pro-military and pro-law enforcement. And I can remember my earliest memories just driving around town, and every traffic circle, you know, rotaries up there or intersection, there was a sign dedicated to a gold star recipient or a bronze star or a silver star recipient. And, you know, flags hanging on overpasses. And, you know, I had my next door neighbor, Mrs. Parker, who was like another grandmother to me. Her son was killed in Vietnam. And I remember just sitting down with her. I would just go over her house at 7 or 8 and just sit down and talk to her, and she'd tell me about her son. And it was always in my head that I wanted to do something, join the military. And I think I've just always been in that mindset of, if you're going to do something, you got to be the best at it. And I had this idea that the SEALs were the best, and if that's what it was, and that's what I wanted to do. And I started reading books. I read Rogue Warrior. I read, you know, all the typical books that were available back then, which it wasn't like nowadays where everybody's writing a book, right? But there was a few, and there's some movies, and, you know, we all saw Charlie Sheen and Navy SEALs and thought that was the coolest thing ever. And yeah, but as far as having a connection to the teams, I didn't know anybody. It was just one of those things where I rolled the dice and said I wanted to do something, and I'll figure out what it is when I get there.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say how Massachusetts is like liberal, but it's super pro-military, pro-law enforcement. I've had the exact same experience, like driving down like little towns, you see the little banners, you know, like everything like pro-military, pro-cops. Like I've had the same experience. And like my family, I have family that are cops, I have friends who are cops in the military as well. So it's
such a generational state, right? You know, if you were a cop, if your dad was a cop, you were going to be a cop. And probably their father was a cop too. The same with the fire department. It was generational. And it's crazy with everything going on now that a lot of these generational police officers, the families, they're now going to the fire department because they don't want to deal with all this drama and BS that's happening, the defund movements and the hate that they're getting. So it's really changing the culture in our state, in my home state of law enforcement.
Yeah. And just I went to make you seem old or anything, but I went to went to Bridgewater State in 2012 to 2016. So that was like when I went.
Yep.
And I studied criminal justice, and we had like professors who were it was during that like height and all that stuff. So it was very like pro or anti-police. And I felt super uncomfortable like being in some classes. But then we had other professors who were like cops, or they were like former FBI agents, and they were like the guys to learn under. That was like the culture shift of that I first started noticing it. And it's a shit show.
It is. And, you know, we can sit here and philosophically talk about why that's happening. But, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I think people are starting to realize that they were, in fact, wrong. And as we lose law enforcement, lose police officers, and they choose different careers, you know, as citizens, we are the recipients of those effects. And, you know, our communities are not as safe. And a lot of places are seeing that now, and it's unfortunate.
So you decided to join the Navy.
Yep.
And then can you just kind of walk through that a little bit?
Yeah, I joined the Navy right after 9/11. I think by the time I actually got into boot camp, it was already 2002. Went to boot camp. I went in on a SEAL contract, which I think they still have that. I don't know. But you basically are guaranteed a shot at buds. So you sign a waiver before you go in, and it says if you go to boot camp and you pass the physical screener test, which is a run, swim, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and then you get to go to BUDS. And I'm like, yep, that's what I want. And they made me pick a rate, and I could care less. So I picked the one that got me out the door quickest, and that was intelligence specialist, and went to boot camp. Did boot camp, took the screener, passed it, got orders to BUDS, but I still had to go to A school, which is the technical school for MOS for the Army people. And that was in Virginia Beach, and knocked that out and went straight to BUDS and didn't really know what to expect. When I got there, you know, I had a general idea, and you know, I hung out with the kids in my division at boot camp and then at A school that were going to BUDS as well. So I started to learn more about what to expect and what we were going to do, you know, other than the books and the movies. I didn't really know much about it. So, yeah, I got out there and I classed up in 247. God, and if you ask me dates, I couldn't even tell you, but 2002 sometime, and made it straight through. It was an experience.
Yeah, I bet it was. And this has kind of become like a naval special warfare sort of history. Like I've had a Korean War frogman. He was from class 6. I've had like a Navy Cross Vietnam recipient. I think he was in 38.
Yeah.
East Coast. So like Virginia Beach training. Yeah. But the point of that is like the foundations of the training since like the 1950s hasn't really changed much. So it's like, you have to be doing something right.
It's true. And it's the way you look at BUDS, it's less of a BUDS isn't making you a Navy SEAL. We'll put it that way. BUDS is just a test of endurance and recoverability and grit and some problem solving. But really, all you have to do is do what you're told and you're going to make it through. And don't quit. That's it. Just don't quit. Suck it up and don't quit, which is easier said than done. But it's a great way to assess, and it's proven. And even in the last 10 years, they put so much effort and time and money into figuring out how to assess people before they get there, so they have a better success rate once the actual the guys actually show up. And the numbers haven't changed. They remain exactly the same since they started doing this thing. So it's really hard to put a finger on an asset or a quality that a person has that allows them to make it through that type of training. But, you know, thankfully there are guys out there that do it and, you know, go on to do great things.
And did you have a BUDS class gift by chance?
Yeah, we did. What the, it's weird. It goes back, you know, our gift wasn't that good because I don't remember what it was. And there are some great ones out there, like the Frogman. I know, I think you talked about that with Alex, like that was a class gift. I remember when I got there was a gladiator helmet, and, you know, I remember the quote, "Are you not entertained?" And that was right on the quarter deck as you walk in. And I'm like, man, that couldn't be more fitting. And then our class gave kind of, we call them like an FU gift, you know, you either give something that's going to last or something that screws over the next class. And I think we did a you know, the big cool zone end zone fans they have on the sidelines when it's hot out and they cool you down. I think we gave one of those and put it at the pool deck. So any class that went through the pool deck had to stand in front of the cold fan, which looking back was a real asshole move for us to do. But I think we just couldn't come up with an idea. And that was really, that was it.
No, that's pretty
probably locked away in a closet somewhere, never to be used again. So we'll see.
And then after Buds, do you have to go to like some other schools and things like that?
Yeah, like I said, Buds is just, it's an endurance test. It's being able to get kicked in the groin repeatedly and get up and ask for more. And you do that for, you know, three phases and then you graduate. You don't really learn much of anything. You do some of the, like hydrographic reconnaissance, which is, you know, a throwback to what they did back in the days before the amphibious units would cross the beach. They send in the UDT guys and they would have a lead line and sinker and they'd be there in their little, like their booty shorts and dive knife. And they would lower the line and they would have readings on the line. They would take the reading and they'd bring it back up and then they'd swim down the beach 10, 20 yards. They'd do it again and they would do the whole beach. And that's how they would know, you know, the areas for the amphibious vehicles to come in and assault the beach in Korea or wherever it was. And you know, that eventually became the SEAL teams. And so when you go to Buds, you do those same training evolutions that they did for those guys back then. And I'm never going to go do a real world lead line sinker hydrographic reconnaissance, right? Because we could probably do it from satellites or underwater submersibles without people in them. And you don't need me, but it really sucks being in 50 whatever degree water in booty shorts and a dive knife and dropping a lead line sinker. So we do it. And it's actually a really cool evolution because you're sitting there thinking, man, for Korea, our guys were doing this real world, which is crazy to think about. And, you know, you wonder what are 50 years from now, what are they going to be doing? You know, throwback evolutions to what we did in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, Africa, wherever we were working. So, so that was Buds. And you know, after that, you go to it's SQT, it used to be called STT, and the SEAL qualification training. And that's when you really start to learn the actual tactics of being a SEAL and how to shoot better, how to move CQB, even anything from land nav, cold weather training. We do that as well. You actually become a little bit more proficient. So when you check up to your team, whatever team you end up at, you have a fundamental baseline that they can then use to teach you whatever it is they're going to be doing on their next deployment. So it's a lot of fun. You're treated much more like call it a gentleman's course. You don't take the same heat that you took in Buds. You're not getting screen bait. You do have physical evolutions as well, but nothing is as bad or as difficult as it was in Buds as far as the stress of just getting kicked in the teeth every day.
That's awesome. And just jumping back real quick, just for the listener, what Sully was talking about, if you go to like the Navy SEAL Museum or you go to like Coronado, there's a statue. It's called the Naked Warrior. And that's because they were shirtless. They just had the booty shorts that Sully was talking about. They had the dive knife. Yeah. They have like that like slate thing, I think. I know when I went out to Coronado for one of the One More Wave guys' retirement, the Buds class they put on that slate, they'll put the active Buds class that's there.
Wax pencil. And yeah, you know, we call them UDT shorts, but for those, they're tan shorts and they're super short. You know, obviously back in the day, that was the style, I guess. I don't know. And we still wear the same ones. That's what you wear. You wear those shorts with a t-shirt and some combat boots and socks and have fun. Yeah.
And then eventually moving on, you go to SEAL Team 2. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. I checked in the SEAL Team 2, which is great. I wanted East Coast. So you can fill out a dream sheet, leave an SQT. And most guys either want West Coast or East Coast. And those are your only options, really, is San Diego or Virginia Beach. I am an East Coast guy. My family's on the East Coast. I was married at the time and my wife wanted to be on the East Coast. So I think I was my dream sheet. I think I picked Team 4, Team 10, Team 2 in that order. And I ended up getting Team 2. The only thing that sucked is it's most of the guys, I think the majority of our class went East Coast, and they did it alphabetically. And myself and another guy, my last name starts with an S, his last name started with a W. We were alphabetically, we were the last two guys in the class. So everybody that went to the East Coast from my class went to Team 10, except for the last two guys of the alphabet. So we ended up at Team 2, which is fine. I was happy to go to Team 2. I kind of disappointed that all my buddies got to go to one team and I didn't. But what really sucked was Team 2 was still deployed when I checked in. So I literally got to the team. Nobody was there. They weren't back for three more weeks. And I was painting walls and waiting. And then the workup is about 18 months back then. So I knew I wasn't deploying and there was two wars going on for 18 months. And all the guys that showed up to Team 10 were going out the door and in like weeks. So it was a tough pill to swallow getting there, but it also got, you know, I was allowed to do a lot of different things that those guys didn't get a chance to do right away. Like going to, you know, jump school wasn't part of the pipeline. So I got to go to jump school. I got to do a lot of cool individual classes because the other guys were still deployed, and you know, silver lining of a shitty situation. Obviously in hindsight, I look back at it and I couldn't have ended up in a better place. The guys that I ended up working with were phenomenal. I had some real experienced senior leadership in my first platoon, and that, you know, if I hadn't have been there, I wouldn't have gotten, and it really shaped my career. And I didn't know it at the time, but looking back 20 something years later, I definitely see that. So things work out for a reason. And I was lucky enough to end up at that team.
And did you have like a specialty? Like some people are like point men or they're like snipers.
Yeah. So at that point, which, and this kind of sucked, but I was a comms guy, JTAC, at Team 2. And that also sucked because you're carrying radios all the time. And it's good to be able to control air and drop bombs and do that kind of stuff. But most guys want to be snipers or breachers or do the quote unquote cooler stuff. And because I was a new guy and they had billets to comm school, they're like, hey, guess what? New guy, you're going to comm school. I got back from comm school. Hey, guess what? New guy, you're going to JTAC. Okay. And, you know, as a new guy, you keep your mouth shut, your ears and eyes open, and you do what you're told, and you try to learn. And that's what I did. And when I got to my first deployment, I got on a significant amount of operations with other teams because I had those quals that guys with two or three pumps didn't get to do because they weren't JTACs or they weren't comms guys. And, you know, it worked out for me. So as much as I didn't like it at the time, man, it opened up some doors for me. So for any new guys, young guys that are listening, you know, hey, I want you to go be a medic or go do that. The more experience and training you have and the more well-rounded of a team guy that you are, the more opportunities you're going to have when you go down range. And that's what it's about. It's about making yourself available and the right guy for every situation. So.
And what was, how long were you at Team 2 for?
So two deployments, about 4 to 5 years, right around there.
And those were both to Iraq?
Both to Iraq, correct. And yeah, I mean, the Iraq war, it was not for us. I know anybody reads some of the books from the guys that were out there that actually worked. We didn't work that much. And you know, there's obviously reasons for it, what's going on, what the climate is politically, what the climate is in country and in this country. But where you end up is huge as well. You're in Baghdad, Fallujah, Habaniya. There's these different places you can end up. But there wasn't a lot of direct action work going on for us. It was a lot of like counter-sniper stuff, a lot of protecting senior dignitaries, presidents and vice presidents of the country and prime ministers. A lot of, we call it busy work, stuff to stay employed and stay in country so that when the operations start happening again, we're there and we're employable. So I was actually pretty disappointed coming out of my second deployment over there because it was not what I really expected this job to be. You know, I thought we'd be running and gunning a lot more. And, you know, I look at some of the other teams that were over there that did work, and knowing what I know now, having, you know, gone on to where I went on to and getting the experience that I have, like I probably was it was probably better that I wasn't in those situations or in those teams. I think we did it the right way. But yeah, but still a tough pill to swallow as a young, aggressive guy and wanted to make a difference and go in there and take the fight to the enemy and make it a safer world for my family, for my friends, for my communities. So yeah, I had a tough decision after that second pump because my enlistment was up and it was get out or screen for GAMNAC. And I screened just to see if I'd get picked up, and I did. And then I talked to my wife and, you know, we decided, well, I would absolutely regret not going to selection for GAMNAC, and I did. So that was 2008.
And how many years did you spend at that command, and maybe like how many deployments, or what was the time period that you were there?
I spent the rest of my career there. So almost 12 years. And my total deployments, it's around 11 or 12 total deployments, and that's varying lengths. So, you know, there's scheduled deployments, and then there's deployments where you go out for something very specific, and you might be gone 30 days, you might be gone 45 days, but you know, as soon as whatever it is you're there is done, you come back. So, you know, it's hard to put a specific number on it, but it's right around a dozen, and it's a different life over there. It's less guys and more experienced guys in a completely different mission set. So it's, you go over there and you work. And, you know, I went through selection in 2008, I made it through, and that is way more stressful than buds will ever be. Because nobody quits selection, they get dropped. So it is a purely performance-based evolution, where you have to perform up to par. And if not, you're basically getting told that you're not good enough for that place. Doesn't mean you're not a good SEAL, right? A lot of good SEALs, a lot of great SEALs don't make it through that selection. It just means you're not right for that specific mission set. So yeah, I got there 08, which you're gone through selection most of the time. And you know, I'm still newly married at this point. As soon as I checked into my squadron, we left, we deployed. And then came back from that deployment, and within a month we left again. And so almost a year and a half of just being gone, which didn't bode well for my marriage, but we worked, and we did the work that we thought. That's exactly why I thought I was joining the Navy. That's why I thought I was going to be when I became a SEAL. And, you know, I wanted to keep doing it. I wanted more.
And we're not going to go into like any of your combat experiences, but I kind of had some, you know, different ones that kind of show the humanity of, you know, guys like yourself. And do you have any like memorable food experiences on any of your deployments?
Yeah. It's funny. I get asked a lot what my favorite place is that I've been to. And it's kind of a loaded question, right? And, you know, I've been in the military. I've got to travel the world. I don't know, 80 countries or something like that. A lot of places. And not all of them good. In fact, most of them are bad places. You know, a lot of countries in the Middle East. But you can still find beauty in those places, in war zones and anywhere. And I mean, God, some of the best, Yemen. I had the best Indian food I've ever had in Sana'a, Yemen. Of all places, right? Go figure. You can't even go in there now. I mean, you'll be dead within, you know, seconds of your feet hitting the ground. But even Afghanistan, when, you know, I had a deployment where I was doing PSD for a general who's still a good friend of mine. And everywhere we went, they would roll out the red carpet for this guy, right? Because he could do things for them, the locals. So some of the food that we got to have in these Afghan villages and you know, with Afghan dignitaries and presidents and heads of states and heads of militias or whatever, it was phenomenal food. It was so good. And if I could find an Afghan restaurant in the U.S. that served food the way they did, I would go there once a week. It was that good. And yeah, it's I am so lucky to have been able to experience cultures across the world, and even in places where we were at war, and to be able to see how they've lived for generations. And, you know, and coming from a country that's hundreds of years old, vice thousands of years old, it's just a different experience.
That's awesome. Do you have like maybe a funny story associated with the food, or maybe just like What type was it, like meats? Were there fruits? Were there vegetables? Mix?
I mean, yeah, the I do, and I don't want to say it because he'll piss, well, this is not names, names, but someone I was with, a lot of them eat with their hands, right? And depending on the financial situation that your host is in, the cleanliness and of the food and of where you're eating and what you're and putting in your mouth is going to be different. So most of the places we would go to in these countries, we would not eat the food. But some of the places, if they were nice enough, we would. And it didn't stop them from using their hands to take food or whatever. And I did one time, one of the guys I was with, one of the locals picked up a sausage and just put it in his mouth. Like in the guy I was with, in his mouth. And just not to be rude, he took it and he ate it. And it was just the most, it was completely normal to the guy that did it. And to us, it was one of the more disgusting things that I've seen. And the fact that he ate it, well, yeah, no. I don't know if I could have done that. Yeah.
That's great.
But yeah, the food, a lot of like you'll see goat, you'll see lamb, but chicken is huge. Not a ton of beef in Afghanistan, outside of goat and lamb. Yemen, everything, anything and everything, in specifically in Sana'a. When you get into the bigger cities, it's different. Coffee shops and all kinds of cool stuff. And Iraq was a popular destination at one point. Obviously a lot different when we were there, but you can get good food there. Not on base, but in certain places.
Did you ever, like, maybe in like Arctic warfare training or some type of training environment, have like an interesting way to cook food or like make coffee, or is maybe not? I don't know.
No, it's. I would say we're pretty spoiled in the teams and in this generation specifically. Maybe every generation feels this because they have things that the generation ahead of them didn't have. But we go out into the do cold weather training in Kodiak, Alaska, and we get these loadouts of gear with Whisperlite little stoves where you can boil water and cook food and go fishing in Alaska and catch salmon and literally walk 2 feet and start cooking it right there. And you don't need to put anything on it because it's the freshest salmon you will ever have. And then there's other times where you've got a can of like Dinty Moore in your backpack and you're so tired and exhausted from rucking all day that you just eat it cold and you don't care. It's still the best thing you've had in days. So we are much more, I think, prepared than the generations before us to be able to endure some shitty situations. And really, it was, you watch some of those, documentaries or miniseries about what they endured in prior conflicts and wars. And yeah, we know better how to prepare for those things. So not a lot of suck in it.
Yeah, that well, it's great that you have those resources. I interviewed I'm gonna have a later podcast. He was a Force Recon Marine in Vietnam and became like some like he became like a historian later on, and he has a really cool career. But he the way to make coffee in Vietnam, they would take like, I don't know how this works, I'm not an explosives guy, but they use like C4 or C3 or something and they to make coffee. I don't know how it happened. He explained it, but I was like, that's sketchy.
I don't know if I would want that, but hey, I did never never question the ingenuity of someone who's stuck in a shithole for an extended period of time, right? You're gonna find ways to make things comfortable. And it might not be to the standard that you do here back home, but whatever it takes to bring a little bit of comfort to you when you're in those situations, you're gonna do it and you're gonna enjoy it and you're gonna remember it for the rest of your life. It's different. So yeah, C4 coffee. I feel like that should be a thing right
Yeah, I agree. And
now.
so like I don't know if like the average person, like the people that listen to this show, of course they would know, but like where you were at, it's pretty much like being like on par with like the NFL or like the NBA, like you're as far as like professionalism. So like the NFL, maybe before a game, guys would do something, they would maybe listen to music or they had like a ritual that they would do. Did you ever have one before you went on like a mission or anything like that?
Yeah, and I think everybody does to some degree. And just Tier one special operations. And obviously in the Navy, most people know what that is. I will never just come out and say it, you know, call it dev group or NSWDG. That's fine. For me, depending on where I'm at in my career, it's a little bit different, right? So as I got to a senior level and being a team leader, a lot of times I am mission planning and watching intel reports and ISR footage pretty much right till we go out the door. So being able to have a quote unquote pre-game ritual is a little bit more difficult. It's literally you are planning until the second you get on that helo. You know, when I was a little younger in my career, we always have a ready room, we call it, and it's where all our gear is. And it's like the locker room in pro sports where everybody's doing what they need to do to get in the right mindset to be able to go do their job. And there's a lot of checking and rechecking and then rechecking again, gear, weapons, making sure everything is functioning the way it needs to be, making sure you have the right tools for whatever it is you're going to be doing that night. And, you know, making sure that your head's in the right spot. And, you know, usually you'll have, and I've never not had this in any platoon, you have that one guy that's just a music nut and they get hold of the radio and they crank whatever the hell they're going to crank. And it's changed over the years from different things. I had a guy that used to play Wild Horses from Silence of the Lambs. Like that was his get pumped music, which he was a nut job. So if you knew him, you'd be like, oh, okay. Yeah, I get that. Or, you know, heavy metal, rock, it didn't matter, whatever the music was. I had guys that used to like to play movies in the background, usually comedies and Wedding Crashers, you name it. Like, and you'd be walking to Target, which sometimes could take 4 hours, and it'd be dead silent because everybody's just obviously maintaining security, and someone will come across the radio and quote a line from Tropic Thunder or whatever. And then you just hear a bunch of guys laughing and people going, shh, shh. And it just, you find ways to deal with stress with comedy. And that was one of the ways we do it. But, you know, and we'd play that before we'd go out, and that would kind of get us in that mindset. So, yeah, it's everybody has their individual ways to do it. And when the team's clicking, those individual ways kind of meld together into something that everybody enjoys and gets focused.
And did you bring any like sentimental items with you? Like when I talked to Alex on episode one, he brought a guitar and he brought a endo board, which is like you could it's to mimic surfing, like a balance board type thing.
Yeah, that sounds like Alex. Yeah. Yeah. I brought a guitar every deployment I went to. You'd think I'd be better, but I'm not. But I'll still dabble now and again. I was never a big video game guy. And I think throughout my career, almost everybody, 75% of the guys would play video games in their downtime. Or there was a 4-year period where Guitar Hero was the thing. And you'd wake up in the morning, you come back from an op, and then these guys just, you know, putting their guns down after this nut drag of an operation, and they can't wait to get in there and finish the debrief so they can go play Guitar Hero and see if they can break their record on whatever song it was. And I'm like, if you assholes actually brought a real instrument, you'd be concert level guitar player by now, as much time as you spend playing video games. But again, some people need mindless entertainment, I think, to unwind. For me, it was focusing on something else. And as I got older, I did school on deployments, trying to finish my degree and finish my master's. So I would be taking classes and studying, and that's how I got my mind off of the day-to-day stuff and sometimes the work.
And what was there like a decision, or of course there was a decision, but how did you decide to leave the Navy or transition out?
I wouldn't say I decided. I would say my body decided for me. I had multiple surgeries. I had some injuries, including getting shot. My kids were getting older to the point where they knew what was going on. Like they were old enough when I got shot to know what happened. And they were old enough to kind of, and it's kind of a funny story. My parents were here with my kids and my ex-wife at the time. And my oldest daughter, I don't remember how old she was at the time, maybe 9 or 10, 11, God, but was kind of asking what happened. And it was right around the time of the attack at the Ariana Grande concert. I don't know if you remember that happening.
Yeah.
And so my daughter associated me getting injured with that attack for whatever reason. So the next day she goes to school and she tells all the kids and teachers at school that her dad got shot saving Ariana Grande. So like I was a hero at my daughter's elementary school for saving, you know, one of their favorite singers, even though I had nothing to do with that, but yeah, whatever. Yeah. Free chocolate milk for me. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That is unique.
But wow. Yeah. So, yeah. So physically I was wore out. My body, like I was to the point where I was having trouble getting up in the morning just because the pain was so high. And surgeries weren't helping. There wasn't much I could do. The only real thing that I thought at that point that was going to make life easier was a lifestyle change, was not putting on, you know, 40 to 80 pounds of gear and hiking 4K to get in firefights and do it repeatedly. So I had a lot of conversations about it, and I thought about my kids and looked pretty introspectively on what I wanted out of life at that point. And I decided it was time. And you know, let the next guy step up and do my job.
What year did you separate?
I've ended up medically retiring in 2020.
And before we go into the nonprofit you have and mm-hmm. the company you have, and since this is a history podcast, I did some research beforehand just to show kind of like the police and the military kind of like cohesiveness with a relationship that they have. And I'll start in like the 20th century. There was the Red Scare in 1919 to 1920. And that was like an anarchist movement, pro-communist. There was a lot of like violent riots and labor disputes. And the anarchists were sending like mail bombs to like prominent politicians and judges and things like that. And at the time, you know, it was just after World War One, so the Boston police, they had like a riot squad, but they also had a machine gun squad, and they used a old World War One, it's called the potato digger machine gun, and they would mount it onto like vehicles. And usually it was just for like riots, but I've researched some newspaper clippings. I've never saw anything about like it them firing it at all. I think it was more just kind of look what we got.
Yeah,
you know. So I got some pictures. When I do the YouTube, I'll probably put those pictures up there. I can text you one of the pictures because it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then as you progress, like the 1920s and the 1930s, you had, of course, like the famous gangster era with Al Capone, like in Chicago, but also, you know, across a lot of the major cities, especially in New England, you had like the Irish mob and the Italian mob. And at the time, all the gangsters in the gang wars, they were getting like firefights using the Thompson submachine gun. So police were really out, you know, they had like pistols and shotguns. They didn't have the type of weaponry needed. So like of course, cops started equipping themselves with the Thompson submachine gun. And, you know, so that's like the early days. And then later on in the 80s, you had like certain military units that would work with like the Secret Service, maybe if it was for EOD or with canines. You had them work with like the FBI's hostage rescue team or SWAT teams at local municipalities, stuff like that. So now we're getting to like present day, you know, veterans like yourself from like the global war on terror. How are you helping out law enforcement as these other military groups have in the past?
Well, and that's a hell of a synopsis. I didn't know that about Boston. That's actually really cool. And you know, I'll say it's impingent upon law enforcement to adapt to the threats that our country is facing. And people hear that and see that, and they assume that it's the militarization of the police. And I do not believe that whatsoever. And I am the first one to tell you that I am not teaching police to be in the military. I'm teaching them to problem solve under stress. That is it, bottom line, because I want my community to be safer. I want my friends, my family to be safer. And I think I have a valuable skill set from my nearly two decades in the teams and dozen deployments and hundreds, if not more, combat operations to where I've gone and I've put myself into active shooter or critical incident response situations. And I'm still here to talk about it and to share my knowledge. So, to go back, when I was at Team 2, so, when I first started, we would do training evolutions out in town. And the reason being is we only have so much, CQB, we'll say, so close quarters battle, tactical training. We only have so many facilities on the military installations, and they're all pretty cookie cutter for the most part, especially back then. So we would always contact police, specifically Virginia Beach, Norfolk, local areas, to see if they had training venues or abandoned buildings out in town that we could use. And we've always in the teams had those relationships with law enforcement to where they would provide facilities that we could train in. And in turn, we would provide fundamental training for them if they find themselves in a critical incident situation where they need to respond with tactical maneuvering. Right? Someone, gets pulled over and pulls out a gun. You need to know what to do. You get a response from, a domestic dispute and you show up and the man or woman has a gun. What do you do? And unfortunately, law enforcement doesn't train outside a SWAT team to be able to respond to that much, if at all. So what we're giving them, and I found this out very early in my career, was invaluable, just the knowledge. And to us, it was really basic stuff that we'd learned throughout the years. And then when I got to Damneck, it's the same thing, but we were able to broaden our reach because we had bigger pots of money to pull from. So we'd go to different cities, including Boston. So one of the first big evolutions I did, we did a training block in Boston where the Boston police provided us with venues to go do these large scale military exercises. And then when we were done, we would bring the police in and we'd provide them some fundamental level training. And it was mostly dealing with SWAT teams, teams that would deploy for these types of situations. So when I got out of the military, I knew I wanted to do something to give back to law enforcement. And I started a company. And the goal of that company was tactical training. And I did it as a contractor first before I incorporated, for-profit entity. And most of my customers were tier one special operations, high, government agencies and high level SWAT teams. So big city SWAT teams. Unfortunately, at that time, we're watching critical incidents on TV now with body worn cameras and closed circuit cameras and security cameras. And we're seeing police officers, patrol officers failing in instances where they're put into high stress critical incidents. And I'm training cops and I'm watching what they're doing and I'm seeing their abilities because it's SWAT teams. And then I'm watching the officers on TV and there's a significant deficiency in performance at the patrol officer, school resource officer level. And, just Google the school shootings, Uvalde, look at, Stoneman Douglas and the incidents that we've seen on TV, the woman and who pulled the pistol instead of her taser and Breonna Taylor and all these critical incidents where the response was failed on the law enforcement side. And I don't blame the police officers, even the ones that were in those situations. I look at it like, well, of course they failed. They've never been taught how to do it properly. And I started digging in and talking to my friends in law enforcement and realizing the only people who really have the training to respond to some of these incidents are SWAT teams and usually larger city SWAT teams with a budget. And unfortunately, they're not the ones who are on scene. Typically, they don't get to scene until a half hour after it's started, right? Because they have a response time where they recall and they grab the gear and then they show up to the scene. So in most of these active shooter situations, it's whoever's closest. It's whatever patrol officer, school resource officer, whoever just happens to be in the area that is responding to it. And that is the person with the least amount of training to be able to successfully navigate that situation. And here I am charging money and making money off of police and military and law enforcement. and I am not making my community or my kids any safer. And that didn't sit right with me. So that's kind of where I came up with the idea to start a nonprofit, 501c3. And I did that in January of 2022. And in about August of 2022, after, you know, building my business plan, incorporating, getting everything done, and you know, really getting feedback from all the police that I knew as to what I could do to affect that community the most, I started raising money and I started training cops. And, you know, specifically in Massachusetts and New England, just because that's where I grew up. And I wanted to get a good proof of concept in the state of Massachusetts, because I felt like if I went into a liberal state with, as a Navy SEAL who wanted to train police officers, and I could get support from the departments, from, you know, the politicians and from the communities, then I could recreate that in any state. And we have. So in the year and a half we've been going, we've raised almost $700,000. And we've trained close to 1,000 police officers. And we are training patrol officers. We're training the officers that need this the most and are getting it the least. And they don't pay anything. And it's been a really humbling and wonderful experience to be able to provide something that is so needed that I know I'm affecting the community that I grew up in. And I want to just keep growing and keep spreading that message and keep providing employment to special operators and training to law enforcement. So it's been a ride, but it's going really well.
That's awesome to hear. And can you, what's the name of your for-profit business? What's the name of your nonprofit business?
For-profit's Blue Force Strategies. And the nonprofit is Community First Project. And obviously you can go online, c1p.org, and check out the website. We are on all the social media platforms. And if you go to the website, you can link to there. But community_first_project is our Instagram handle. You can link from there as well. And I did not expect it to grow as fast as it did and to get the feedback as quick as we have. And I hate to say it. I love to say it. I hardly have time for the for-profit stuff right now. Which not the best financial situation for me in that sense, but I don't care. Like I didn't start this for the money. I started this because same reason I joined the military, because I'm a service oriented person and I want to protect my people. And this is the best way that I know how to do that, is to take all this knowledge that I have and that my guys have from 2 decades of sustained combat operations and give it to the people now who need it the most. In doing so, I'm protecting communities and families and kids. And that makes me feel good.
And do you train like entire departments, or is it like an individual cop or patrolman will reach out to you? And how's that kind of work?
So it's been departments reaching out. I'll get individual people reach out for their departments. And usually we'll do anywhere from 25 to 30 officers at a time in a training class. And a class lasts about a week. And it's the fundamentals of a tactical response to an active shooter or a critical incident, an act of terror. And, you know, we're taking officers who really have never had any tactical training whatsoever and trying to get them to a basic level of proficiency so that they can continue to train throughout their careers, and they have that baseline, fundamental ability to improve. And you know, I tell people that there isn't anything I can teach in a week that is the end all, the be all, but we can identify problems and we can help build a training plan for the departments to fix that going forward. But it is going to take a combined effort to fix this problem. You know, you're asking officers to respond to a tier one Navy SEAL level operation with no training, or now a week of training. And it's just not enough. So we need to figure out a way to reform training in law enforcement so that our officers are prepared to meet the changing climate in our country.
And what are some, like, when you say train fundamentals, or like, what is your course kind of look like? For say if an officer wants to apply or go through the training, what could they expect?
So it can vary. I will, let's say a department calls me. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to sit down and find out what their training pipeline looks like. Have they had active shooter training? Have they had tactical training at the patrol officer level? If so, what is it? Is it an 8-hour course where half of it's spent in the classroom, or are they actually putting them through scenario-based training? What I do is scenario-based. I spend as little time in a classroom as possible, and I put officers into stressful situations and teach them how to respond better. Right. So, and we're not a cookie cutter course at all, but one of the last ones I did, we showed up and we did a range day where we brought these officers out to a range to shoot. And when you look at the patrol officer level, most officers in the country, they shoot 10 to 15 hours a year. That's their mandatory. And that's not to say that officers won't go shoot on their own time or other departments don't shoot more than some, but the average police officer in the US is I think 12 to 15 hours. And the majority of that is shooting a qual to be able to carry their weapon. It isn't tactical shooting. So we'll start with some tactical shooting, be able to shoot with a partner, being able to shoot, move offhand, transitions between weapon systems, basic, fundamentals in shooting offhand, offline, moving while shooting, things that they never do, and doing it in a safe situation. And then the rest of the week, we'll go and we'll apply that to a tactical response to critical incidents. Like, how do you enter a room where you think there's a shooter on the other side of that door? Right? What are some strategies you can employ if you're by yourself, if you're with one other person, if you're with a team? And then we'll do that for a couple of days and get them to a basic level of proficiency. And then we'll spend the last day and a half to 2 days putting them through situational based exercises that we design with role players and, trying to recreate a real world situation as realistically as possible to get their stress levels high. So they have to make really difficult, life threatening decisions under stress. And that really isn't happening across the country right now in law enforcement. Maybe a few departments are doing something like that, but for the most part, they're not.
And I know you worked with like Boston Police. What mm-hmm. other Massachusetts police departments or have you worked with?
Yeah, we've Boston Police. We've worked with all Metrolex, so all the cities surrounding Boston. We're talking to Quincy. We worked with Framingham. Attleboro and the two towns surrounding them. Talking to Hingham and Scituate right now as well. Quite a few, and it's not enough, right? Our limiting factor right now is our budget, and we burn through our budget both years we've been in, and I probably trained about 25% of the departments that reach out to us because I just didn't have the funding to train the rest. So my job has, as the president of this organization, has unfortunately become fundraising and business development. I don't get to do the training, which kind of stinks because that's what I like to do. And fortunately, I have a great line of guys waiting to jump in for me and take over and more than capable of doing the job as well, if not better than I am. And, for me now, it's okay. I've 15, 16 states now have reached out to me for training. How do I start raising money in those states? How do I start raising money in Florida, New York, California, Tennessee, Virginia, all these places that they need help, and I'm trying to be the one to provide it. And we got to figure out a way to get it into their hands.
Is there like a goal to, establish like a base level or a foundational level of training? So like, say if there's like a, something happens in Quincy, right? And then Braintree responds, and then another town responds, but they might not have the same training. So is that like the goal to make everybody gets on the same page pretty much?
Absolutely. And that's everywhere, right? And you look at Uvalde, that's a prime example of it. Look at Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. Departments show up from neighboring cities and they don't know who's in charge and they don't know the tactics that they use to be able to assimilate into a single responding unit. And if you look at that strategically or tactically or however you want to look at it, that's a failure. And I will point to the Marathon bombing as a fantastic example of what happens when you integrate departments and agencies and all these people together and try to have a coordinated response. It's almost impossible if you don't train and rehearse, and that just isn't happening. And unfortunately, that's a debrief point from the Marathon bombing, and it's still not happening. It's still, you know, the FBI doesn't go train with BPD or state police, you know, maybe a little bit here and there at the tactical level, but certainly not at the patrol officer level. And, you know, if you want a different outcome, you have to train the way you work and train in the response. And if you don't, the outcome is going to be the same every time. And we're seeing that in the active shooter stuff. You know, we talk about training and providing officers with this and courses. And at the end of the day, every active shooter situation seems to end the same. And it's unfortunate. And there's many things we need to do to prevent those things from happening, whether it's, you know, on the gun side or the mental health side or whatever you want. But until that happens, I am going to provide the best response that I know. You know, my instruction isn't preventing it from happening. It's what do we do when it's happening and how do we end it as soon as possible to save lives.
And what has been the most rewarding part of this endeavor for you?
There's a few things. One, I think one of the things that I wasn't expecting is the mental health side of this for police has been pretty significant. And, you know, I always ask, hey, what can we do differently? What do you need? And resoundingly, everybody I've talked to, they need help on the mental health side in law enforcement. And coming from a community where that's been a significant issue for the past 10, 15 years, if not longer, like I understand. And you know, we have a pillar where we're trying to pair up officers who've been involved in shootings or have been involved where they've been shot or injured. And we pair them up with someone from my community who has had a similar incident or a similar injury for just peer mediation. Hey, this is how I got through it. This is what I did. If you need me, call me. And that has really been a great development that I didn't expect when I started this. The other one is at the end of the week and getting the evals from the students that go through the course, the officers, and finding out how grateful they are to have it, the opportunity to get it, and how much it's helped them. And I've had two instances now where a officer has used tactics that I've taught in a real world situation and did a phenomenal job. And to the point where I got feedback and a thank you, because it wouldn't have gone the way it had gone had they not had that fundamental instruction. And that's what it's all about. And yeah, it's, I say a third one also is providing some purpose and employment for people in my community who are leaving. You know, you leave a tier one special operation unit, you are at the pinnacle. Like that is literally the tip of the spear. And it can be really difficult to find purpose when you walk away from something like that, because it's like stepping off the train keeps going and now you're standing still. So we're providing a platform for these guys coming out with all this knowledge to be able to give it back to people that really need it. And it's been great. And I have more guys calling me now as we get more exposure and grow, looking for something to do, not as a full-time job, but as a placeholder to allow them to transition comfortably into whatever is going to be next for them. And it benefits everybody. So yeah, that was a long-winded answer to say that I get a lot out of this.
Long-winded, but it sounds like your mission and everything you're doing is amazing. And I definitely support everything. I mean,
I appreciate it.
Just especially like the mental health aspect. I mean, for like decades and decades, cops, like it's always been like kind of like a, or even firefighters, like a suffering silence type thing, just like the military, you know, the culture's changing, or at least as far as the military side, it sounds like it is now as far as law enforcement and first responder side. So that's amazing. Second point, amazing. I keep saying amazing. I got to find a different word, but like the training feedback that you get from like a real world situation. And then, you know, you always hear stories about people or maybe like your friends or your family when they're transitioning out, how difficult it is. So it's great that you're
providing your friends and teammates a platform. Lastly, I wanted to give you, like, how are you getting the message out? And can you talk a little bit about the Army-Navy game?
Do we have to talk about that?
No, we don't.
Yeah, unfortunately, Army won this year and last year. But, yeah, we did a nice little fundraiser at the Army-Navy game this year. And we had some really good sponsorship to where we were able to get tickets and auctioned some of them off and brought a really good crew, about 50 people, to the game. We did a big dinner the night before. The Omni Hotel Seaport in Boston was phenomenal. They hooked us up. All our people stayed there. We rented out the restaurant at, you know, a ridiculous price, just because they're so supportive of what we're doing. And, you know, we took a bus to the game, watched the game, went back into the city. It was just a really good experience, with the exception of Navy losing. But I heard Belichick's going to coach Navy.
I hope he does.
Yeah, isn't that? Yeah. We would love that. You know, another 20 years of Belichick, but at the Naval Academy, another Belichick at the Naval Academy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was a lot of work. We raised some decent money, but, you know, whether we do it again next year's in DC, you know, the big thing for me was doing it at Gillette and getting support from my home state. So I don't know if I'll do it again next year, but we'll do something. And, you know, I'm guaranteeing a Navy win next year. You heard it here first.
Yeah, especially if Belichick goes. And yeah, it'd be kind of like a fairy tale ending, you know, obviously where New England, Massachusetts guys, if you don't know, Belichick, his dad went to the Naval Academy. I think he was a coach, or
he coached football.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Belichick's a huge supporter of Naval Academy. He has a Naval Academy player on the team all the time. You know, Joe Cardona, the long snapper, is still at the team. So he's always supported the military.
And like, he was, I don't know if you saw, he was at game day and he wore like a helmet and he was talking to like all the fans and stuff. You know, you were probably doing, yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought it was pretty cool. He was really talking up the Naval Academy and the traditions and all that stuff. So
it was a hell of an event, man. The Kraft family did a phenomenal job of hosting. The city did a phenomenal job, or the state of Massachusetts and the city of Boston, of having events throughout the week. It was just really, really well done, especially since it hasn't ever been done in the state before. So it was great. It was a great experience.
That's awesome. And closing thoughts, do you have anything last to say or things to plug?
You know, check the website out, c1p.org. Follow us on social media, please. You know, we got hats on sale and shirts coming, everything. Any profit we make, it goes right into the you know, to training cops. You know, we are not keeping any of it. It all goes back in. So feel free to spread the word. If anybody listening is a police officer and wants to chat, you can email me on the website or hit me up on social media. My personal one is at Sully_C1P. If you have ideas for sponsorships or fundraising, please reach out. Again, the only limiting factor we have in training law enforcement is the ability to fund the training. More money, the more training. It's that simple. So any ideas, I'm all, you know, I'm this is two businesses I started. I've never started a business. I don't have an MBA. I've been, you know, YouTube and how to do QuickBooks. Like, I figured this out on my own. Fortunately, we got up and running quick, and I've had the right people join me along the way to where I'm getting the support I need now, which is fantastic. But at the end of the day, it's about building the network and meeting the right people to be able to grow this. And that's what I need. So share, listen, like, anything you can do to help us out, that's what we need.
Well, thanks, Sully, for coming on the Late Night History Podcast with me, Matt Freitas.
Thanks, Matt. Great talk.